This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Bill McKibben, author of more than a dozen books, including The End of Nature, Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age, and Deep Economy. A former staff writer for The New Yorker, Bill often writes for Harper's, National Geographic, and the New York Review of Books, among other publications, and is also scholar-in-residence at Middlebury College. He is the founder of the environmental organizations Step It Up and 350.org, a global warming awareness campaign that in October 2009 coordinated what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. Bill McKibben is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, published in 2010 by Times Books, an imprint of Henry Holt and Company. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, what a pleasure to be here.
In the title of your book, the spelling of Earth has an extra A. Would you explain why you put an extra A in the spelling of Earth?
Absolutely. I did it to get people's attention. We started warning people 20-some years ago, a lot of us, about what was going to happen if we didn't do anything about climate change, and we didn't do anything. And hence, the world has begun to change, and in ways fundamental enough that we're no longer justified in thinking about it as the planet in which we were born. Look, the number of continents is still the same. Gravity still applies. But the atmosphere holds 5% more moisture than it did 40 years ago. Warm air holds more water vapor. That means that we see these tremendous deluges and downpours, record rainfalls around the world, place after place. The oceans are 30% more acid because they're absorbing all that carbon. Everything frozen on this planet is melting, and so the way that our globe looks from outer space is different now than it was just a few years ago. There's a lot less white on top. The Earth is changing fast enough that we probably should start thinking about it as a slightly new planet, in part because that will clue us into the fact that we're going to need some new habits to live successfully on it.
Would you go into more detail about how the physical features of the Earth are changing? And in particular, would you go into more detail about how the hydrological cycle has been changed and what you call our transition from oasis to desert?
Sure. And it depends where you are, because some places we're seeing desert and some places we're seeing swamp. One of the more important physical facts of the 21st century is what I just mentioned, that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. That means that in arid areas, you get increased evaporation. That explains a lot of the drought that we've seen across Australia, across the American Southwest, on and on and on. Once that water is up in the atmosphere, it's eventually going to come down, which means that we have remarkable increases in really heavy rainfall, the kind that does no one any good. At this latitude, about a 25% increase in the storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. We saw this winter the amazing snowfall across Washington, D.C., not just the biggest snows they've ever had, but biggest by a factor of two or three. And it's because there's record amounts of moisture in the atmosphere. 2 weeks ago, it was Rio de Janeiro's turn. They had the biggest rainstorms they'd ever had. They killed hundreds of people and left hundreds of thousands homeless as landslides swept away whole villages. You know, last summer, it was the relentless march of typhoons across the Pacific, dropping insane amounts of rain. There was one storm that stalled over Taiwan, the mountains of Taiwan, for 3 days, and when it was over, 9.5 feet of rain had fallen. I mean, even by Seattle's elevated standards, that's a lot of rain.
Is there any hope of reversing the changes that you've described?
We've raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree. We're going to raise the temperature of the planet another degree almost for sure because we've put enough carbon in the air already to cause that. Those changes probably aren't going to go away in any humanly significant time frame. We don't have a method for refreezing the Arctic, you know. What we have to do now is figure out how to get it from getting much, much worse, because though the planet has changed already, it can change in even more dramatic ways. Scientists tell us that the 1 degree we've already raised the temperature and the 2 degrees we're already committed to are but the tip of the iceberg. If we don't get off fossil fuel very quickly, then we're looking at 5 or 6 degrees temperature increase this century alone. If 1 degree melts the Arctic, we do not want to find out what 5 or 6 degrees will do.
What are some of the most challenging issues we will have to deal with as a result of having destabilized our climate?
I think one of them surely is agriculture. Nothing is as evolved for the climate that we enjoy as the principal crops. Corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, all like the temperature, need the relative temperature range that we're in. And if the temperature goes up very much, they begin to see dramatic drop-offs in yield. Corn doesn't fertilize if it's above 90 degrees for 5 or 6 days in a row. Rice yields drop precipitously. The forecast, including by one important scientist at the University of Washington, is that we will see grain shortfalls on the order of 20, 30, 40% if we let temperatures increase as they may in the course of this century. That's simply the temperature factor. We're also seeing place after place across the big grain-growing belts where drought and increased evaporation are also taking their toll on grain production. The amount of grain produced per capita in this world has gone down each of the last 10 years. The number of hungry people has risen each of the last 3 years. And this happens even without, you know, crazy experiments like converting a third of the American corn crop into gasoline, the sort of ethanol idea. So agriculture is clearly one of the places where this will pinch, and if it pinches there, it has enormous implications. Hungry people move. Hungry people fight. The Pentagon has begun to understand that the most chaotic threats we face in this century aren't from Islamic terrorism. That's probably containable. It's from this chaos that leads to unpredictable, violent conflict more often than not.
Would you speak also about how an increase in the number of extreme weather events will make it harder to get insurance and how society will be affected by difficulties getting insurance?
Sure. This is a good question, Diane, and it bears on the kind of economic implications of what we're doing. We take the physical stability of the planet for granted, but it's actually a great economic asset. One of the things it's allowed us to do is develop the insurance industry, which is one of the great underpinnings of our system. The actuarial table is an amazing piece of technology. It allows us to make very well-defined bets to hedge risk and hence to take risk. The problem is that an actuarial table is dependent on the world behaving in the future as it has in the past. That's how we decide how much to charge and whatever. If the world of the future is dramatically different from the world of the past, then that technology becomes kind of useless. And you have to start charging a lot more if you're an insurance company trying to hedge risk. There are already large parts of this country, especially along the Gulf coasts, where you can't easily get insurance anymore, where people are turning to the government as an insurer of last resort. That quickly starts to take its toll just in terms of economic development. That access to capital becomes harder if investors can't hedge that risk, if much of that capital gets eaten up in insurance cost. The biggest insurance company in the world, Swiss Reinsurance, and the Harvard School of Public Health did a joint study a couple of years ago, and what they concluded was that as extreme events become more common, as their their return rate increases as you get storms more regularly. It's not at all unlikely, they said, that parts of even the U.S. will begin to resemble third world economies in their inability to keep pace with this damage.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bill McKibben, author of the book Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you say more about how the need to address the fallout from extreme weather events will affect development in the developing countries?
Sure. Among other things, these countries are poor, and hence they have to make very excruciating choices all the time about how to spend what money they have. And if that money is increasingly being taken up dealing with emergencies, then you have a real problem. So look at the health field. Dengue fever, a mosquito-borne disease, is spreading like wildfire across Asia and South America. The incidence is up 200% in the last decade because mosquitoes like the warm, wet world that we're building. That's bad news. It's bad news for the people who get it. Having had dengue myself in Bangladesh, I can attest that it's nasty stuff. It's also bad news for the governments that then have to deal with it. They don't have huge health budgets, you know. And if they're spending what health budget they do have transfusing people with dengue to keep them alive, that's money that's not getting spent on family planning, on AIDS prevention, on measles vaccinations, on all the other things that should be going on to allow a sort of steady pace of development. Now they're engaged in crisis management, and that's a very different thing.
Would you speak about the psychological aspects of living on a changed planet?
Well, I think beyond just the kind of root instability that we're going to have to deal with, the fact that things are more chaotic, I think that the first thing we're going to start to notice is our old prescriptions for how we deal with problems are no longer as effective. For many years, the default option for Americans has, for every problem that we've faced, has been growth and more of it. And it's avoided us having to make tough choices in all kinds of ways. But we're running into a planet in which that growth becomes more difficult. Those limits to growth that people began talking about at the first Earth Day 40 years ago are starting to sink in. I mean, when you melt the Arctic, that's a bad sign. And so it'll be important to start thinking more creatively about what we want out of the world. I think the key words going forward are words like stability and resilience and security more than growth. I think it'll take us a while psychologically to kind of get there, although there are signs that we're starting to understand it already. I mean, the fallout from the financial crisis of the last few years is clearly people less obsessed with getting high returns on their money and more obsessed with making sure that they don't lose it, that they have it in some place secure to guard for the future.
What can we do to protect our civilization on a changed planet? What are the most important steps to take?
The most important steps to take, I think, are to start building down these systems that are too big to fail. So our banking system was too big to fail, but it did fail, and expensively. Our agriculture and energy systems are too big to fail, too. They're centralized in the same way that our banks were. Instead of Goldman Sachs and AIG, you have Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland. You have Exxon and Peabody Coal. We need to start building that down and spreading that out. And it's beginning to happen. In this country, the fastest growing part of the food economy for 15 years now has been local farmers markets. And as a result, over the last 5 years, for the first time in a century and a half, the number of farms in America is growing, not shrinking. People are beginning to build the kind of local agricultural networks to meet that demand. We need to make that happen much more quickly. We need to make most parts of the country, if not food independent, then much more able to take care of what they need themselves. With energy, the same story. Instead of a few centralized, huge power stations, which has been the logical outcome of a dependence on energy-dense fossil fuel, reliance on the sun and the wind, which are much more diffuse and dispersed, dictate that we move in the direction of what the engineers call distributed generation. Lots of solar panels on lots of rooftops, helping build a new kind of grid, a kind of farmer's market in energy, if you will.
Would you speak also about going from the federal to the state, local, and neighborhood level as a place to have governance?
Yeah. I think it's one of the places where conservatives have offered a useful critique of our society in certain ways. Our federal government's gotten very large. Indeed, our nation has gotten very large. As you can tell from looking at Washington, we teeter on the edge of complete dysfunction at all times, symbolized by the fact that for 20 years we've done nothing to deal with climate change, the biggest problem we've ever faced. Going forward, as our economies begin to decentralize and spread out, so I would think would some of our governmental power. Now, I come from the state of Vermont, which has a very long tradition of governing itself by town meeting, by local, each town getting together each year and in public going through its budget and figuring out what it's going to do. And that tradition is one that's been very useful to us.
Going back to the issue of growth, which you say we need to get away from, what do you see as the major steps preventing us from going away from a growth model?
I think that the first step we need to take is to figure out, and it's not that hard to do, how to put a serious price on carbon, how to make coal and gas and oil pay the freight for the damage they do in the environment. And when that happens, new economic paradigms will begin to emerge almost as if by magic. All of a sudden, it'll make a lot more economic sense as well as culinary sense to shop at the farmer's market, because you'll be able suddenly to see the enormous subsidy that we've been giving that 2,000-mile tomato for a long time. So I think that's the first and most important step that we can take to deal with this whole suite of problems. It's what we're fighting for in Congress and the UN.
You've alluded to this, but you specifically speak in your book about the need to get rid of complexity. Would you expand on this idea?
One of the things that fossil fuel has allowed is an ever-growing complexity of our economy, to the point where only about 1% of us now engage in the core business of raising food, of being farmers. We have twice as many prisoners as farmers in America. And I think it's symbolic of the fact that to one degree or another, we're going to have to loosen some of the centralization that's allowed that specialization. Our systems are tied too tightly together. And when things begin to go awry someplace in any of them, then bad consequences ensue across the whole board. So you get one plant in the Midwest that's putting out tainted meat, and suddenly people in 46 states are doubled over sick, you know, or dying. That's way too tightly coupled a system. It makes a lot more sense, and it's a lot simpler to have much of what we eat in the Northwest grown in the Northwest and stay in this general neck of the woods.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bill McKibben, author of the book Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Looking forward towards our life on a changed planet, what are the essential things that we need to have on that planet?
Well, I mean, the essential commodities are, of course, you know, food and energy and water. But I think we overlook at our peril what may be the most important commodity of all, and that's a strong sense of community, of connectedness. One of the things that fossil fuel has done is allow us to become the first of our species with no real need of our neighbors for anything. And we've taken that all to the good as a virtuous experiment in self-reliance. But in fact, it's helped make us fairly miserable. The average American has half as many close friends as the average American of 50 years ago. So one of the good things about these transitions that we need to make is that they tend us in the direction of community. The average shopper at a farmer's market has 10 times as many conversations per visit as the average shopper at a supermarket. That's a real difference and an important one.
In terms of food production, which of course is one of the essential things that we'll need to have, you pointed out that probably the type of food system we'll have will require a lot more labor because it's going to be more local and on smaller plots of land. So what fraction of the population do you see as being involved primarily in agriculture?
Oh, I don't have a good number for you, and I don't think it's, I think it's crazy to try to predict with any specificity exactly how the world will look. Trajectory is what's important. We need to get the right economic signals in place in terms of things like a price on fuel, and that will spur the natural market-led development of things like local agriculture. It also will help if government will do some of the work of replacing the lost infrastructure that we need. There's a lot of parts of this country without slaughterhouses and canneries and things like that anymore, and it'd be very useful to have them back.
What role do you see for the Internet in our future?
I think the Internet is one of those good wild cards that may help us a lot. Among other things, it mimics that spread out, distributed architecture that I described for energy or food. It's not like broadcast television where you've got a few big stations beaming at us. It's like a farmer's market in information. Everybody brings something to Facebook and everybody takes something away, you know? We've used it to organize at 350.org very successfully and across the globe. I think that it offers for the first time the real possibility of staying at home and living a very local economic life and yet being deeply tied and connected to the rest of the world. Not having to make the choice between staying at home and going out in the world and making something of yourself. I think we'll need to replace a lot of the travel that we do, the unsustainable jet travel, for instance, with travel along the ganglia of the internet. You can do 1,000 Google searches for the energy that it takes to drive a car 0.6 miles. That's a good thing.
Would you say more about the internet and the role it can play in promoting community?
There are some wonderful experiments, including ones near us in Vermont that I describe in the book, where people have really managed to use the internet in ways that introduce people back to their neighbors in real time, help them overcome our tendency towards social isolation and instead meet face-to-face as neighbors. If people check out the section in the book about this thing called Front Porch Forum across Vermont, it's now won all kinds of awards. It's a real inspiration and a fairly low-tech use of the internet without a lot of flash and panache that nonetheless has penetrated very deep in the places where it's been used.
And how does the Front Porch Forum work?
People write every day for each neighborhood. You know, they set up different forums for a neighborhood maybe 10 blocks in size. And on it, people every day, you get a digest of 5 or 6 messages from your neighbors. Some of them are lost cat things. Some of them are recommendations for babysitters. Some of them are things about block parties coming up. Some of them are people saying, I need help doing this and this and this. And it's worked remarkably well. It turns out that there's lots of people who wish to be good neighbors and want to be in touch with the people around them, but feel kind of isolated and have forgotten some of those social skills. And this is a good way back in.
How soon do you see these changes taking place that we've been talking about?
Well, they're taking place already. The question is whether we can make them happen fast enough to put a significant dent in the problems we face going forward, whether we can engineer a transformation quickly enough to matter in terms of carbon and climate. And that, I think, depends entirely on how big a movement we're able to build, and hence how much change we're able to exact from our Congress and from the UN and global bodies. Whether or not we can put a stiff enough price on carbon fast enough will tell the tale. Right now, we haven't built a movement strong enough to do that, and so we get lousy legislation in Congress, if we get any at all.
At this point, what do you see as the best steps to take to prevent further global warming?
Well, I've described already the most important, putting this price on fossil fuel. And the only way that will happen is if we organize politically. So we hope people will join us at 350.org. The number comes from what the NASA scientists have told us is the most carbon we can safely have in the atmosphere measured in parts per million. We've taken that and organized around the world. Last October, on our first big global day of action, we had 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries. Foreign Policy magazine just wrote a piece saying it was the largest coordinated global rally of any kind on any issue at any time. And it took those numbers and made them count when we went to Copenhagen for the climate summit. We had 117 nations that signed on to that target. They were the wrong 117 nations, the poor ones. We aren't yet able to influence as directly the most addicted nations, principally our own. So we continue our work. This year it'll be October 10th, 10-10-10, a global work party. All around the world, people will be putting up solar panels or wind turbines or digging community gardens. Not because we can solve this problem one project at a time, we cannot. Because we want to send a pointed message to our leaders. We're getting to work. What about you?
What is your evaluation of the climate change legislation?
I think the best piece of legislation in the Senate, and it's not getting much traction yet, comes from your senator, Maria Cantwell, working with her Republican colleague from Maine, Susan Collins. This cap and dividend law would do good things. It would put effective science-based caps on carbon, take the money and send it back out to all of us instead of awarding it as a free gift to electric utilities and big corporate interests. The legislation that Senators Kerry and Graham and Lieberman are supposed to be debuting sometime in the next few days is much less useful. It's mostly a kind of cobbled together kludge of corporate giveaways. It may prevent the EPA from taking effective action against carbon. It may preempt states from doing more innovative things and pushing the standards further. It's a gift to big interests, and I think it probably will do more damage than good.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the message of Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, is that things are very tough, and we need to take cognizance of them right away, but that we can, that there are things to be done to allow us to inhabit successfully even the damaged planet we now live on. And some of those things are political, and that's what we work on at 350.org, and some of them are very much in your communities, and that's what we need to be working on all over the world.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Bill.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You have just been listening to Bill McKibben, author of the book Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, published in 2010 by Time Books, an imprint of Henry Holt & Company. For more information, check on the web at www.350.org. Again, that's www.350.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP. dot org.